stuff that we'll just jump right in.
You are listening to The Extra Environmentalist on CITR 101.9 FM.
Dr. Michael Husman, thanks for joining us from Arizona today. You're a research scientist with a special interest in sustainability and critical science. You've specialized in environmental biotechnology for more than 25 years, and we're here today to talk about your recent book, Technofix.
Yeah, it's nice to be here.
So, Michael, after a career in developing technology, what prompted you to start writing Technofix in the first place?
Yeah, I come from a rather long family tradition of science and engineering. My great-grandfather had a PhD in chemistry, and both my father and my grandfather both were mechanical engineers. So when I grew up, there was no question what my profession should be. I should clearly study engineering. And so my motivation early on, when I was even a teenager, was, oh, I want to study engineering to help society, to help the environment. And so I picked chemical engineering and went off to college. But after I got my PhD in chemical engineering, I joined a very large multinational company, and I was somewhat naive. I joined them in the environmental research department, and I thought, oh, they're going to use environmental research to clean up the environment, to help the environment. And I was, as I mentioned, a little bit naive. They really use the environmental research to change regulations, to make regulations, environmental regulations, more lenient. And so at some point it actually came to a clash between me and management. I defended my research plans, my experimental design in front of all these managers, and said, well, this is the best design because it's unbiased and objective. They said, we are not really interested in this. We would like you to change this to get better results at the end. And I said, well, I can't do it. I want to do unbiased research. And then one manager told me, well, Michael, you are not hired here to do science. You can do science on the weekend. And so I left that company. And soon afterwards, however, I realized that even with supposedly unbiased research, when I looked through many, I must have read thousands of research papers and also research proposals in the environmental area, and also most of that research was unbiased and objective, I sort of felt that most of the research actually was not really helping that environment that much. There was not much implementation of these ideas to protect and help the environment. And so I got more and more frustrated with this lack of progress. And so I started thinking about what's going on here with science and technology. Can science and technology really help the environment? Can it really solve the problems of society? And so it took me really to study this question for 15 years. This is not just a short project. And at some point in the middle of this project, my wife Joyce joined me, and she has a doctorate in statistics and a master's degree in anthropology. And so she could make an interesting contribution to this project because of her cross-cultural perspectives from this anthropological background. So it became a very interesting project for many years. And as a result of our long collaborative research, we believe that Technofix is one of the most comprehensive and thought-provoking critiques of modern science and technology.
What is it like working with your wife so closely on such intricate projects?
Well, it is interesting because it results in rather intense discussions over breakfast and lunch and dinner. You know, it's very interesting, but of course it results also sometimes in conflicts in terms of conflicting viewpoints, but it results in a more interesting overall perspective at the end of the process. So we wrote different parts of the books and then edited each other's part. So there was also some cross-fertilization at that level. So that was interesting.
In taking the title Technofix, can you tell us why you chose that title and why technology won't save us?
A technofix is basically an attempt to solve a problem with technology by addressing only the symptoms instead of the root cause. And it's called a fix because it does not really result in long-term lasting solutions. So technofixes are attempts to solve either problems caused by previous technologies or to solve social problems. Let me give you a few examples about solving problems caused by previous technologies. Two examples. One is traffic congestion. The root cause of traffic congestion, of course, is too many cars, too many drivers, too many miles driven. And the techno fix is to build more roads. And, you know, there's always this idea, if we build more roads, traffic congestion will disappear. But it has been known for over 100 years that building more roads attracts more traffic, so it makes the problem worse. So that's a good example of a techno fix. Now, we have a whole other series of techno fixes appearing here on the horizon for climate change mitigation technologies. You know, climate change is primarily caused, as everyone knows, by fossil fuel combustion, CO2 emissions related to fossil fuel combustion. So scientists try to get already start thinking about how to get rid of this excess CO2. So there are these concepts of pumping the CO2 into the ground called geological carbon sequestration. The problem with this is we don't know whether it will stay in the ground, whether it can leak out. And then when it leaks out, the CO2 leaks out of the ground, whether it will have health or environmental impacts. Then other scientists have come up with the concept of pumping the CO2, the excess CO2, into the deep ocean. But then we don't know what happens to the pH, whether the ocean will acidify, and what will happen to the deep sea creatures. And then even another idea is to sprinkle a little fertilizer over hundreds of square miles of ocean to stimulate phytoplankton growth. Because as soon as phytoplankton, algae, start growing, then they suck out CO2 from the air to grow, like, you know, any plant does during photosynthesis. But the question there is, again, what will happen if you have all these algae blooms all over the ocean? What will happen to the food web, the whole nutrient cycles, etc.? So we can see that techno fixes have three problems. The first thing is they always have unanticipated side effects. And the second problem is they are never really providing long-term lasting solutions because they never address the root cause of the problem. And then the third problem with fixes is they cover up symptoms and often make problems worse. And so that's why techno fixes are a bad idea.
What are the unintended consequences of technology? And do you have any examples of how these unintended consequences stack up or add up?
First, I would like to mention that unintended consequences of technology actually cannot be even avoided and cannot be predicted. So that's a pretty bad combination. Let me give you an example why environmental consequences of technologies are inevitable. The main reason is that as soon as you apply technology in a natural system, that at least three different ecological laws are violated, and by violating these laws, you have unintended consequences. And these laws have been called by Barry Commoner the laws of ecology. Barry Commoner was an activist biology professor many years ago, and he wrote a number of books on that topic. So the first law of ecology is called everything is connected to everything else. So if you apply a technology to a natural environment to manipulate the natural environment, because everything is connected to everything else, there will be unintended consequences in another part of that system. If you manipulate it in one part of the system, there will be a consequence in another part of the system. Then technology also violates the second law of ecology, which Barry Commoner called nature knows best. Nature knows best means that nature, over billions of years of evolution, has really optimized all the interactions within these natural systems have been optimized by something called, you know, natural research and development, if you want to call evolution natural research and development. And so, because everything has been optimized to function in a good way, if humans come in with technology to manipulate nature, they basically disturb this intricate optimized balance, and so there will be automatically negative consequences. And then the third law of ecology was called there is no such thing as free lunch, meaning that you have to pay for what you get, i.e. if you extract something from a natural environment for your benefit, for human benefit, there is a cost associated with it. There's a price to be paid. And that price is basically the environmental problems we have right now. All the problems that show up are the price that shows up, or the cost that show up in a delayed way. And one would think, well, if all these consequences cannot be avoided, at least it would be nice if scientists could be able to predict them. And the problem is the scientific method is not good enough for scientists to predict all these unintended consequences. The current scientific method, which has been around now for 200-300 years, is based on mechanistic reductionism, meaning that you can try to understand the whole by looking at isolated parts, by looking only at one cause and effect relationship at a time. Like when we do laboratory experiment, we just only vary one parameter to look what effect that has. So we look only at one cause and effect relationship. The problem is we don't look at all the other millions of other cause and effect relationships that might be out there when we start manipulating nature with technology in one area. We do not know what all the other consequences might be because our scientific method is not good enough to elucidate all these different cause and effect relationships that are out there in nature. So let me give you two examples of unintended consequences just briefly. One was from the car culture we have for over 100 years. I am sure that the people who first invented the car, the automobile, did not know that this would take off like crazy. Right now we have over 160 million cars in the United States and over 530 million worldwide. Cars have actually killed more people than World War I and II combined. 30 million humans have been killed by cars. And of course, we are all aware of the unintended environmental consequences from smog, oil spills, climate change, urban sprawl, etc. Let me give you one more example of an unintended consequences in medicine. That is antibiotic resistance. 60 years ago, penicillin was invented, and I'm sure most doctors were not aware about the problem of antibiotic resistance, and as a result of antibiotic resistance, there are more than 2 million hospital infections each year in the United States alone because of antibiotic-resistant pathogens. So we can see that even in medicine, not only in the environmental area and also in other technology-related areas, there are unintended consequences that are unpredictable and unavoidable. So that's really sort of a bad combination.
So I always hear that technology is a neutral tool and that, you know, the consequences aren't really the problem so much of the people who are experiencing the technology. It's the people who are taking the technology and using it in the wrong way. And the technology itself is just a neutral tool. What do you have to say about that?
What you are referring to here is called the myth of value neutrality, that technologies are simply neutral tools which can be used for good or evil purposes depending on who controls them. And the problem with this myth is, of course, like all myths, they are not correct, but the problem is that all technologies, particularly the technologies that are more specifically designed for a specific purpose, embody the values of the designer. Basically, the development of a technology is a creative process, and because the designer has to make choices what to include and what to exclude, and by making these choices, there are value judgments to be made, and these values are embodied in the final technology. For instance, let me give you a number of examples. It is very clear that most military technologies have a built-in bias towards violence. So they have, they basically embody the value of violent conflict resolution, if you want to call it that way. That nuclear energy, for instance, because nuclear energy, the generation of nuclear energy requires large capital, a large plant. It's very difficult for just one individual person to manage it. So it requires centralized control. And because of that, nuclear energy has an automatic bias towards centralized control. It can't be controlled in a decentralized way. And also has a bias towards environmental risk because it generates radioactive waste. Genetic engineering technologies are commodifying plants and animals, so they objectify nature. There's another hidden value there just in genetic engineering technologies. And even something simple as television has a built-in bias or let's call it promotes individualism and consumerism. So because people sit by themselves watching the screen, the same applies to a computer screen also, but let's talk about TV. They basically interact with the TV screen by themselves as individuals. So just the TV technology, the television technology, has a built-in bias towards individualism. And why is this really a problem? I mean, should we be worried about the technologies embody values? Well, the problem is, as soon as technologies get diffused through society on a large scale, like 99% of US households now have televisions, and 95%, I think, watch them regularly for 5 hours per day. So if you have massive diffusion of a technology throughout society, then suddenly the values get transferred into the society, and the society adapts those values and gets influenced by it. For instance, like with TV, the community life is weakened because if everybody or almost everybody watches 5 hours per day television as an individual in front of the TV, then there's less time for social interactions. And the same can be also seen with technology transfer to third world nations. As soon as you transfer technology like television, cell phones, computer technology to third world nations, suddenly their whole culture changes in a completely unanticipated way. At least those people are very surprised about it, but it's really not surprising because the technology embodies the values of those who designed them. And so that's why I at least believe that it is dangerous to believe that technology is value neutral.
I was reading the other day in Time magazine, it was an article talking about this group called the Breakthrough Institute, and it's a guy named Nordhaus is one of the people heading it up. And he was saying that because of the challenges that we're facing in our world today, we don't have any other option to develop technology in no way that we've ever done before and to accelerate innovation, and because we needed the help of technology as fast as possible. What would you say to someone like that?
I agree that innovation, particularly technological innovation, is necessary to solve our environmental and social problems. The only problem is that most technological innovation today is used for two overarching purposes. That means building better weapons or improved consumer products to increase profits of corporations. So I believe that as long as technological innovation is focused on maximizing profit and stimulating economic growth, environmental problems are unlikely to be solved. If technological innovation, however, is applied within a new framework of a steady state economy, it has great potential to solve environmental problems. Let me explain what I mean by a steady state economy. A steady state economy is a no growth economy where there is zero growth, which means that material affluence per capita GDP, gross domestic product, and population size both stay more or less constant. So this is different from today where both affluence is increasing and also population size is increasing. So we need to apply technological innovation within the framework of a steady state economy. Let me give you an example why it doesn't work otherwise. If you still have a growth economy, why technological innovation will not necessarily work. For instance, a lot of engineering innovation has been used to build more energy efficient cars. There will only be a reduction of energy use if there's no increase in the total number of miles people drive worldwide. If there's continuous growth in driving, in more driving, more drivers, more distance driven, if you build more energy efficient cars, it will not make much of a dent in the total fuel or gasoline or diesel, whatever fuel used. And this is actually confirmed by the data. They did some studies and they found out that from 1974 to 1998, there was an increase in fuel efficiency in industrialized countries by 20%. So cars became 20% more fuel efficient between 1974 and 1998, but total fuel consumption increased nevertheless by 40%. And why? Because people started driving much more, had more cars and drove longer distances by 75%. So this clearly shows that if we want to protect the environment with technological innovation, we first have to transition to a steady state economy, to eliminate growth, to have a steady state economy, and then apply technological innovation to reduce resource use and pollution.
A steady state economy is necessary before we can start using the technology. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's correct. Because if you use a technology within the framework of a growth economy, it stimulates more growth. That's actually the main purpose of technology today. Economists have done, it's called factor analysis in neoclassical growth theory. They have analyzed that up to 80% of all economic growth, particularly the material affluence, the per capita GDP, about 80% of that is due to technological innovation, to having more and better technology. So basically, technology at this point is promoting economic growth. You need to have it the other way around. You need to fix economic growth to zero. I mean, you have to limit economic growth so it becomes a steady state economy, and then use technological innovation to reduce resource use and to reduce pollution. This is not my idea. This is Herman Daly at University of Maryland, and he formerly worked for the World Bank. He has written many books on that topic for the last 40 years or so. It's called Steady State Economy, and that's probably one of the most important steps to reach sustainability in the future, to achieve sustainability in the future.
So many of us in the Western world have this kind of grandiose, optimistic view of technology. It's going to fix all of our problems. Any kind of problem that you can think of, technology is going to solve it. Why do we have such faith and optimism in that technology will solve these problems? And what is the origin of this techno-optimism?
Yeah, this was interesting. When my wife and me did research on that, we had the same question, really. And there's not that much out there written on that topic, but we found out that agricultural societies have a cyclical view of time. And as long as you have a cyclical view of time because of the seasons repeating themselves each year, so you have a cyclical view of time. And if you have a cyclical view of time, apparently you do not have a concept of progress, because things just repeat themselves year after year and nothing progresses towards a certain goal or to some kind of paradise. However, at some point, probably with the rise of Christianity, there was a switch from a cyclical concept of time to a linear concept of time. And as soon as there's a linear concept of time, the whole idea of progress becomes possible. I just would like to point out that even the Greeks and Romans did not have a concept of progress because they still had the cyclical time. But then after that, with Christianity, the idea of progress started and really took off with Enlightenment, when the idea that reason, particular human reason, and with the help of science and technology can promote progress, material progress, and not just social and moral progress, but particularly material progress. And the reason why technological optimism particularly is strong today, there are at least two reasons. So the first one is very obvious. Technology has been extremely impressive in delivering the goods, if you want to call it that way. We have cars, computers, cell phones, fax machines, internet, etc. However, the problem is, as I mentioned earlier, it is very easy to be impressed by technologies, but the problem is we don't know what the unintended consequences will be, not only the environmental consequences, but also consequences on society as a whole and culture. So until the chickens come home to roost, so to speak, we will be very optimistic about technologies. The other reason why we are so optimistic is because we are almost continuously bombarded by the mass media, by advertising that there are these new techno gadgets, the new products, etc., that will make us happy and that will solve our problems. But we need to recognize that, of course, this is a very biased view of technology, because there is a vested interest here by companies to sell these technological products and goods and services. And so there is a vested interest here to keep techno-optimism alive. I personally believe that actually techno-optimism is based to a large degree on ignorance of the relevant facts. We coined something in technofix, we called it optimism is inversely proportional to knowledge, meaning the more knowledge you have, the less optimistic you will be, and the least you know, the more optimistic you will be. And I have seen it at technical conferences when a scientist presents something or an engineer presents a new concept, the people who know least about this area are very impressed by these new ideas. But if you talk to a person who's working in the same field, those people, those experts, are much less optimistic. They have much more guarded optimism. So, and the problem then, of course, is that scientific literacy, or let's call it rather illiteracy, in the United States is rather alarming. According to a National Science Foundation report that was published a few years ago, 80% of Americans do not meet minimal standards of scientific literacy. 50% of Americans do not believe in evolution. Now it's getting even more interesting. 28% of Americans believe in astrology, 25% in witches, and 33% in extraterrestrial visitors. This is all according to the National Science Foundation report. So we can see here that scientific illiteracy is rather extreme, and that's why techno-optimism is extreme.
Do any of those facts shock you at all? I mean, witches are pretty far out.
Yeah, I was really shocked about it, and I have the numbers here in front of me. I don't know whether, you know, it's a National Science Foundation report. I assume it's correct. It's based on two statistical sampling and surveys. So I know the 50% evolution, I think it's probably correct for the United States, but extraterrestrial visitors and witches, that is more bizarre, I agree.
Coming from Germany, is that different? Do you think that Germany would stack up in a slightly different way?
In terms of illiteracy, I think I do not believe that Germans are quite that illiterate in terms of science and scientific knowledge. I also, this whole concept of evolution is much more, or the theory of evolution, I think, is accepted in European countries to a much larger degree than here. I don't know whether that's 100%, but it's probably closer to 100%. In Germany. Astrology, I don't know. I think there are always people who believe in astrology. Witches, I don't know. I can't. And extraterrestrial visitors, I just don't know. But however, techno-optimism is pretty rampant in Europe as well. However, interesting that you bring it up, I remember from the National Science Foundation report that techno-optimism is the strongest in the United States, and that in Europe, the European countries are less techno-optimistic, have less faith in technology. But it's still pretty high, but it is less than the United States. So I don't know whether it's linked to illiteracy or scientific literacy or not, but that's an interesting point.
So previous to modern culture, there have been many other cultures, the Romans, the Greeks, lots of rises of civilization, and lots of advances in human civilization. Why didn't previous civilization use scientific exploration to develop technological processes? Is it because we're smarter than they are? Are they because we have access to oil? What is the reason that we made the advances and leaps in technology that we did?
The main difference between previous civilizations and our modern Western civilization is their respective worldviews. Previous civilizations like Romans and Greeks, despite their interest in advancing scientific knowledge, believed in universal harmony and balance. These ancient civilizations were suspicious of technologies because it was considered an application of brute force and implied the absence of virtues such as self-control and moderation. Now, by contrast, ever since the Enlightenment, our modern Western civilization has been guided by the worldview to exploit and dominate nature and to apply science and technology for this purpose. So there have been very few signs of restraint. Now, the question whether we are just smarter is subject to debate, of course. Our technologies have severely damaged the environment, and with the threat of global climate change might very well bring us to the brink of collapse.
Going back to our modern worldview about technology, we often talk about the need for efficiency. Our economies talk about the need for efficiency, but also I'm always hearing about how new technologies are making us more and more efficient, and that there's a need to move to clean energy technologies to make our electricity and energy use more efficient. What do you think about the need for efficiency in clean energy technologies?
Well, I believe that efficiency improvements are important for reducing pollution and achieving sustainability. However, total resource use is only reduced if efficiency improvements occur at a rate that is faster than the rate of growth in demand for these resources. I guess I mentioned that earlier. It's a little complicated. Let me explain again with another energy efficiency examples. For instance, energy efficiency in the Western industrialized nations increased by 50% between 1973 and 2000. So there was a rather significant increase in energy efficiency. But total energy use still increased by 36%. Why? Because the size of the economy, measured as GDP, gross domestic product, grew by 200% during this time period. So in this case, the energy efficiency improvements could not keep pace with the fast rate of economic growth. And that's why I mentioned before the need for a steady state economy. We first need to have a steady state economy and then apply efficiency improvements to reduce resource use and pollution. Now, you mentioned clean energy technologies. Well, there's clearly a need for clean energy technologies. However, we need to recognize that the potential of clean energy technologies is often limited, and that there could also be significant environmental impacts if these technologies are deployed on the large scale needed to replace petroleum. For instance, let me give you an example from biomass, energy from biomass. In the United States, half of the biomass, the U.S. vegetation, is already harvested for agricultural crops and forest products. So we already appropriate half of that photosynthetically fixed energy, if you want to call it that way. So if we wanted to, we could only increase biomass energy by a factor of 2, because there's only so much land left. We already use half of the United States land, and so we would need to use the remaining land area to grow biomass for fuel. And we can see this would have environmental consequences, because we would crowd out or destroy species, destroy potentially ecosystems. So we can see here biomass energy, renewable biomass energy, is rather limited in the United States, and there would be unintended consequences if we would increase it much more than it's currently done. The same is true for the worldwide production of biomass for biofuels. For instance, if we were to supply the current worldwide energy demand solely with biomass, we would require 10% of the total Earth's surface. This is the same amount that is currently used already for agriculture. Again, we see here we would have to double the land under cultivation to produce biofuels. I don't think there is that land available. We already pretty much maxed out in terms of agricultural production. To double the land for agricultural production worldwide would clearly have environmental impacts, might not even be possible. And even if it would be possible, then you would have this conflict, this ethical conflict. Should we grow biomass to make fuel for our gas tanks, or should we make biomass to feed people? So we have this conflict between food versus fuel. So, and I
don't know. Food's kind of overrated.
Okay, fine.
America's infrastructure is collapsing. We've had some shocking glimpses. The levees in New Orleans. The interstate bridge that went down in Minneapolis. The massive East Coast blackout of 2003.
Imagine a month-long blackout. Imagine major failures of water delivery system in the West. imagine levee breakdowns that can't be repaired.
We're headed down the road, without much exaggeration, to being a second world or a third world country.
A massive power outage that affected millions of people in America's Southwest highlighted vulnerabilities in the nation's power infrastructure. The outage caused reactors to shut down at San Onofre Nuclear Power Plant and cut power to wastewater pumps, sending tons of sewage into the ocean.
The Great Transbay Bridge, longest in the world, is open, connecting San Francisco with Oakland. It's an engineering masterpiece.
Last year in September, a crack was found in that masterpiece. A month later, this cable snapped off. It's part of a growing trend that if you build it, it will break.
We have not always underfunded road repair in the country. In fact, since the interstates were constructed, or at least construction began in the late 50s, there was a fairly good source of revenue for construction and maintenance of interstates provided by fossil fuel-based taxation, basically cents per mile or cents per gallon of tax. And as long as people were driving more over time, that is, vehicle miles traveled per year was rising, since it essentially has done pretty much continuously since that time, then there was a lot of revenue for the expansion and maintenance of our roads, bridges, and tunnels.
But now that revenue is diminishing.
It is. And there's a couple of factors that are driving that change, I think. The main one, in my view, is increasing fuel efficiency of vehicles, which means that people can drive more vehicle miles but don't pay proportionally more in fuel taxes.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it, though? I mean, we're getting more efficient, and that means that it's having an effect on the roads and on the roads and bridges that we're traveling on.
Right. That's right, Carrie. It's you used the term ironic. Mary Peters, a former U.S. Secretary of Transportation, used the term a policy at war with itself. Because on one level, we're encouraging people to drive more fuel-efficient cars, I believe, for very sound reasons. But on the other hand, we rely on fossil fuel consumption in order to fund the infrastructure that those folks are driving on. So there really is a very deep and profound tension between those two policies.
The Pray at the Pump movement held a small prayer protest asking God to lower the price of gasoline. Founder Rocky Twyman led the group in song.
Bring the gas prices down. I'm gonna let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine. Let it shine.
Ah, you want to join in with us? We're praying for lower gas prices, brother. And we have a book here for everybody to sign. It's called The Book of Prayers for Lower Gas Prices.
How will I ever change if I am willing to just stay the same? And if I make a change, when will it feel like I'm not just the same?
Did you do really well in a first or second year course? Want to make a difference in the UBC community and school communities around the world? Join Students Offering Support, or SOS, and become a tutor today. Math, accounting, economics, psychology, engineering courses, French and Spanish, statistics, and more. If you aced it, Students Offering Support wants you to help other students ace it too. Check out UBCStudentsOfferingSupport.com for more information.
You are listening to The Extra Environmentalist on CITR 101.9 FM. And today, we're speaking with Joel Heath, the filmmaker behind People of a Feather. Because our show today is about the impacts of technology that aren't seen. When you were in the Arctic and looking at the impacts of hydroelectric power, we often think that hydroelectric power is this clean, green energy source. And it has lower emissions than, say, burning coal or something like that. But it's causing some serious problems in the Arctic. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, for sure. I think I had the same perspective as well when I first went up to the Arctic. I was thinking about climate change and environmental change, and hydroelectric projects weren't on my radar at all. So it was a little confusing for me at first when people started talking about the effects of hydroelectric on the ocean and on the sea ice. And so it took me a while to kind of digest that and understand it. Part of the what I learned about that was how fresh water on the top of the ocean in the middle of winter affects how the ice forms. And so because fresh water freezes at warmer temperatures than salt water, if you get a cold snap, you can get really extensive areas freezing over really quick, a lot quicker than normal. And so that can kind of trap animals. Eider ducks and belugas are actually getting entrapped quite a bit recently as well. They get they're stuck at the head of a bay. Things freeze over really quick, and they can't hold their breath long enough to get out to the edge of the ice, kind of thing. And so in some ways, it's causing a lot more ice at some times of the year, like in the middle of winter particularly. It's also different ice because it freezes. It's a bit more brittle and less flexible than saltwater ice. But then at other times of the year, like in the spring and in the fall, the water is kind of coming down when it shouldn't normally be. It's been, instead of coming down in the spring with the spring runoff when it's normally cold water that cleans the land, it's been sitting in reservoirs until people need the electricity at the opposite time of the year. And so when it comes down, when the ice is forming, it kind of keeps it from forming. And the same thing in the spring when the ice is breaking up, it kind of accelerates that breakup. And so at those times of the year, it causes less ice, whereas in the middle of the winter, it causes more ice. And so it's kind of changing the whole dynamics of sea ice. And Inuit think it's actually having a bigger impact than climate change on sea ice habitats in Hudson Bay.
Wow. And so when you were there in Hudson Bay, did you see impacts of climate change, or when you're talking to people, were they aware of different changes that they were noticing in animal migration patterns due to climate change? Or was it more so this dynamic of hydroelectric power changing the way the currents worked in the area?
Yeah, it changes the currents as well as kind of the ice freezing dynamics and that as well. And when we initially went up there through the Canadian Wildlife Service, there had been large die-offs of eider ducks that had been there in the early 90s. There extensive areas had frozen up really quickly, and thousands of birds were trapped. And they were actually coming into the community. The closest thing to open water was like the roofs of people's houses. You could put out a tarp, and like birds would land there. And so they were just kind of scattered over the ice. And so people were really concerned, and they contacted the Canadian Wildlife Service to let them know and try and understand the problem a bit better. And so that's how I initially went up, was to try and to study the problem. And we'd seen a bunch of die-offs right from the first year that we got up there of birds getting trapped in the ice, kind of thing.
At that point, were people aware in the community that it was the problem of hydroelectricity that was causing a lot of this? Or did they just see the die-offs and think, here's some additional problem that we didn't expect that's starting to happen?
Yeah, I think that the elders had known a lot about hydroelectric projects. People had been concerned about it for a long time. The initial projects went in the 70s, but more recently they significantly expanded the complex. So in the 90s, the Great Whale project had been proposed, and that was on a river further north of the Le Grand complex. And so people had actually, the Inuit and Cree had actually gone to New York City and were able to actually shut down that project based on their concerns. And then more recently, the Rupert River, which is the next river further south instead of further north, was approved. So it's basically the same project on a different river. And that just became operational in 2010. So it was something that was definitely that people were concerned about. A lot of people, climate change was kind of really getting on people's radar around the same time as well. I mean, Inuit had noticed a lot of climate changing since the 80s and that as well. But it's difficult to disentangle some of the effects of both climate change and hydroelectric change there as well, because they're kind of both acting together.
Yeah, and I guess really the main point is that our lifestyle and our energy demand is having a major impact on the traditional lifestyle of these people. And I'm wondering, where is the electricity from these hydro projects going? Is it going to Canadian cities? Is it going to American cities? What region is it flowing towards?
Yeah, it's going to both, actually. A lot of the power is used in Quebec, and a lot of it also is exported to the States, particularly New York City. And so the big problem is that electricity demands peak in the middle of winter, where spring runoff normally happens in the spring. So we're not just trying to be doom and gloom here. We really think that hydroelectric projects do have a lot of advantages over other energy sources like burning coal. And so the main problem is in terms of how they store the energy as water behind the dam and how they distribute it. So certainly there are energy demands that do happen in the spring that coincide with the hydrological cycle. So we're interested to try and start a dialogue with the industry to think about how they could store it and distribute it differently that would work with the hydrological cycle. So we're burning coal in Nova Scotia, shipping on the St. Lawrence, kind of peaks in the spring as well. And so, for example, Iceland had a plan where they would use hydroelectric projects to produce hydrogen fuel. And you need a lot of water, and that's obviously not a problem for a hydroelectric project. And then they were going to use that hydrogen fuel to power their shipping industry, because ships could kind of manage the technology. Because they're heavy anyways and float, they could maintain these big fuel cells in that. And so that kind of working between multiple energy sectors could really help solve the problem of working with the hydrological cycle on the marine environments, but also help us get off fossil fuels. And for shipping, like, there's chronic oil spills that happen all along the St. Lawrence River and off Newfoundland all the time. That's a big issue. So it would help solve multiple problems at the same time across energy sectors.
So it's not about saying, you know, hydro is this terrible thing. It's about saying that as long as we can adapt hydro to work within hydrological cycles, then here is something that can, coupled with different other solutions, could help get us off fossil fuels.
Yeah, exactly. So I think there's a lot of hope and possibilities there. We just need to open a dialogue with the hydroelectric industry to try and to move forward on that. I think overall, a lot of projects have improved significantly in terms of thinking about how the rivers that are flooded, the area that's flooded, and the estuaries and that kind of thing. But the marine environment is something that just hasn't been on people's radar anywhere. But of course, all that water goes somewhere, right? And so in terms of sea ice habitats, it has a particularly noticeable effect. But I think there's definitely impacts that are happening on the marine environments all around the world. And, you know, this affects our ocean currents, our ocean circulation, and our global climate is driven by our oceans. And so I think it's particularly how salt water sinks in the Labrador Current and drives the Gulf Stream. And so I think it's something that we really need to think about, the cumulative impact, not just of one project, but of all the rivers that we have dammed all over the world.
Right. And so, as you're mentioning before, it's completely changing the habitat of the eider duck. And could you speak for a minute just about what that means to the people there in Hudson Bay and what the relevance is of the duck's life cycle to their life cycle?
Yeah, so our film is very much a cultural film. People have relied on eiders for hundreds of years. There was no caribou on the Belcher Islands, and so people used them for their food and for their clothing traditionally. And they made these beautiful eider skin clothing that we were able to recreate for the film, for the traditional recreation sequences. And these days they still are just as important. They use the down in modern parkas. They hunt them in the fall. It's local free-range organic country food for them that's really healthy. And so it's really important. And not to say, I mean, eiders are really symbolic. They're kind of the canary in the coal mine in this film. And the ice changing affects people's safety traveling on the ice. It's critical habitat for polar bears and for whales like belugas, like I mentioned, that are getting entrapped, as well as for eider ducks. So it affects the whole ecosystem.
Right. And so did the community put out a call for help to say, let's get an ecologist in here and start studying this? Or how did you first find out about the dynamic that was going on here?
Yeah, my colleague and former supervisor, Grant Gilchrist, at Environment Canada, had been contacted by them. And so he was up there working with them. They redid surveys that had been done in the 80s and showed that there was a 75% decline in the eider population compared to those surveys. And so I came on as a PhD student with them and was trying to look at, you know, what sort of factors affect the ability of eider ducks to get through the winter. So I was filming the birds diving underneath the ice, looking at how much food they get, how much energy it takes for them to get their food, and looking at kind of energy budgets and their foraging behavior, and using that to kind of model population dynamics and understand how their individual foraging affects their ability to survive winter. And so we kind of have this approach where we can understand how different environmental conditions would allow birds to survive or not. And so we're using that for management kind of perspectives.
And you took some of the film techniques that you developed in this scientific research and used it actually in the film. Could you talk a little bit about the different time-lapse techniques that you developed while doing your research?
Yeah, for sure. I think a big strength of the film was that I went up there. I didn't have an intention to make a film when I originally went up there, but I had a camera. I was filming underwater, and we were getting this amazing footage underneath the ice. that was really inspiring, and we wanted to try and use that to show the rest of the world that what was going on, kind of thing. And yeah, the time-lapse technology, we're just kind of developing the battery capacity and SLRs, and it really was revealing of how sea ice moves and changes. Everything works at a different time scale in the north, so time-lapse is really critical to kind of to see and what's going on. So we use the time-lapse quantitatively. We can get the computer to count birds or other wildlife in the images, as well as to track sea ice edges and that kind of thing. But just aesthetically as well as qualitatively, I really didn't understand how flow edges break and move and the dynamics of sea ice until I was able to see it in time-lapse as well. So it's really beautiful to watch the ice kind of moving over these long time periods and going up and down with the tides and flow edges breaking off with the wind and moving in and closing up. It's pretty incredible way to see and understand the ecosystem up there. So there's definitely lots of scenes of that in the film as well that kind of really help people understand a little bit more about these ecosystems.
Yeah, absolutely gorgeous scenery. And so when you showed these images and these videos to the people there, were they touched by it? Did it help kind of fill in the gaps of stories and things that they knew were happening, but then they could finally see it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, personally, I've really learned almost everything I know about sea ice dynamics from the Inuit, and which I think was the best way to know. They have just an incredible knowledge about the whole system, and just from the fine details of testing the ice with a harpoon where you're going to walk to kind of the larger scale dynamics. And it was really great to be able to give something back as well. And so people hadn't really seen the birds diving underneath the ice, for example. And the head of the Hunters and Trappers Association, when he first saw it, I remember his comment was, "I remember when our people had to work that hard to get their food because the birds are really working against the currents." And so that was pretty cool to hear him say that.
Wow, yeah.
Same for the time lapse. I mean, people have been out on the line and they spend extensive periods out on the line, so they see some of these things happening in real time and they're just there over the long term. But I think generally them seeing the time lapse. And we're using it for community-based monitoring as well, so we've trained Inuit to set up these time-lapse cameras to help us quantify the changes that they've been seeing. And so with that, we don't have to show them a graph to show them how they're contributing. We can just play the video back and say, "Look, this is what you helped. This is the data that you helped us get." And so it really is a way to communicate with the community as well and engage them in our research and monitoring.
So it's a citizen-based science in many ways.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, nothing would happen without the community, for sure. But we're trying to develop the capacity. And over international polar year, we have been able to train people and get the infrastructure in place so that people can be monitoring the community themselves and kind of helping provide oceanographic equipment. So when people are out hunting on the land, they can just drop down a salinity profiler, and that can help us understand these freshwater plumes that are happening, as well as the time lapse to monitor the ice. So we can be supporting people going out to get local free-range organic country food for their community and at the same time quantifying the changes that they're seeing in the environment.
And so what was it like to start building a relationship with the Inuit there? Did you start learning the language and start actually learning more about their culture? What really surprised you when you were there for so many winters?
Yeah, I mean, I just became really good friends with a lot of the guys. We were out working on the ice for months at a time, kind of thing, living in a cabin, sometimes in a tent, fighting off polar bears, lots of things to bring us together, kind of thing. And I know a little bit of Inuktitut, but it took me a long time even just to listen to what they were saying, and I'm still very much an amateur at that. But it's such an important part of understanding and knowing the language. I mean, there's so much language about sea ice and just their way of thinking. Even when people speak in English, the way they phrase things, I've learned a little bit to understand how that reflects their way of thinking about it and how Inuktitut is structured as well.
What do you think it's like to grow up as youth in Nunavut? You have this scene in the film with all of the kids sitting around and rapping and everything. You know, they're so isolated. What did you really see from the experience of the youth there in those communities?
They're great. I have a lot of fun. It's been really great to work with them and to get to know them. And they're really passionate and enthusiastic. They like making music. They like hanging out and we showed the film just this week again in the community this year, and the teachers at the school said that the kids, it was like the quietest they've ever been. They were all just like totally engrossed in the film, and because it's their place, it's out on the land, and Some of them get out on the land hunting with their parents, but not all of them do. And so it's a chance to kind of see things in their own backyard and be inspired by that. And one really amazing thing that's happened is that Simeone, the main character in the film, his son Daniel, who's also in the film, it's his first winter hunting in the film. We were able to capture that. And now he's up in Iqaluit. He's training to be the first wildlife officer, the first Inuk wildlife officer for his community. So it's really encouraging. And I think the next generation is in good hands for sure.
Fantastic. And what was it like when you actually brought the film up to the communities that you worked in and showed it to them?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a lot of the community was involved. Almost every family was involved, whether it be giving us traditional knowledge to help form the screenplay and the recreations, or creating the traditional clothing, recreating the traditional kayaks. And there's so many people involved. So at first we were a little nervous, of course. And I was sitting there with Johnny Kudlorik, who's one of my best buddies and also who helped throughout all the behind-the-scenes kind of stuff. And he was kind of like, if people say nothing, we'll know it's good, because if they don't like it, they'll tell you. But people are super enthusiastic. They were patting us on the back, and there's a huge applause. And so we knew that we had the momentum behind us to take it to the rest of the world then. And the reception has been the same in the South. And it was amazing. We brought Simeone and Johnny down to Toronto for hot dogs and to Vancouver for VIF. And they're coming to Montreal for a release there this April. And they were able to see the response of people in the South to it as well. And feel really encouraged by that and take that back to the community. So it's been really exciting. It's been awesome.
Yeah, that's a beautiful experience to help unite the entire Canadian community like that, and to be able to tell that story that we really don't have in all of the southern parts of Canada. And now you're going into the United States, and that's where you're at right now, where I'm speaking to you over the phone. And how do you feel that the reception is in the United States in areas where there isn't an Arctic? Do you think that the story is still resonating with people in the U.S.?
Yeah, for sure. I think people are still really interested in the culture. I mean, the Arctic is kind of a big focus for a lot of people in the States as well. It's been a similar response to in Canada, for sure. We haven't premiered on the East Coast. We've been in Washington, D.C. for the Environmental Film Festival, but we're really looking forward to going to places like New York, where people are actually using the electricity that influences how the rivers flow there as well. And so it's good. The momentum is building, and so we're going to take that to the East Coast as well.
Fantastic. And the showings you had in Vancouver had such a high demand for additional showings, because so many people enjoyed the film so much. It's actually coming back to Vancouver, and I believe that's this coming weekend?
Yeah, it's coming back to both Vancouver and Victoria. We were turning people away. We had like 50 extra people this Saturday in Victoria. And so we're opening at the Empire Theatres at the Capitol 6 in Victoria, and at Fifth Avenue in Vancouver starting this Friday for a full week, with multiple screenings, 4 screenings per day at Fifth Avenue and a couple at Empire Cinema. So we're really excited about that. The BC has been amazing. We won the best BC film of 2011 and won the best environmental film at VIF. And so I'm based in Vancouver, and so it's been really amazing to feel that kind of hometown support that's really helping us take it to the rest of the country and the world. So we're really excited about that.
That closes out our show today. Thanks for listening, and check out our website at www.extraenvironmentalist.com. We'll see you next week.
I can feel it all the way down in my plums, getting all swollen, with a light blue hue to them, fresh and juicy, ready for the picking. I want to bite into that plum and let the juice spill down my chin. You know what I mean?
CITR Campus Radio. Can you feel it?
I can feel it down in my plums. They're getting a nice bluish hue. Getting ready to take them to the farmer's market. Special 2 plums for 1.